All right. Welcome to episode 643 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the free 86 series. Again, guys, I'm telling you, if you're taking your USMLEs anytime soon, don't ignore this stuff. It's going to pop up on your exams. All right. So we're going to pick up from question 37. A 35-year-old white man with spina bifida is admitted to the hospital for a urologic procedure. He has been functionally independent in activities of daily living and is employed doing inventory control in a local sporting goods store. He has maintained continence through periodic self-catheterization. The patient is paraplegic, has recurrent calcium oxalate kidney stones, and recent onset of incontinence secondary to detrosal and bladder neck dysfunction. Vital signs are normal. Physical examination shows a well-developed, well-nourished man in no acute distress. Aside from paraplegia, lower extremity muscle atrophy, and lower abdominal surgical scars, the physical examination discloses no abnormalities. He had an episode of anaphylaxis secondary to latex allergy during a previous operation for functional expansion of his bladder through a bowel anastomosis. Which of the following is most important to consider in the care of this patient? A. Administration of injectable medications with disposable syringes. B. Preparation of food by outside contractors. C. Type of cleaning agents used to sterilize bed linens. D. Use of rubber urethral catheters. E. Use of topical moisturizing agents for skincare. For this, I'm going to go ahead and say D, right? And again, that makes sense. Why? Because this person, they've had anaphylaxis with, the person has latex allergy. And remember, latex allergy can absolutely positively cause anaphylaxis, right? So you don't want to be exposed to latex ever again. And I won't be surprised that this guy developed his sensitivity to latex because he's been heavily involved with the healthcare system, right? When people have these like neurological disorders or they were born preterm or whatever, right? They tend to be in the hospital for a while. They tend to be in and out of the hospital a lot, right? So those people may develop a sensitivity to latex because so many healthcare workers have touched them and they've developed a latex sensitivity. All right. Question 38. A 14-year-old boy is brought to the walk-in clinic by his father late on a Saturday afternoon because his left ear is swollen and painful. The ear has been black and blue since he injured it in a wrestling match 3 days ago. Symptoms have increased significantly following a repeat injury during a match 3 hours ago. Vital signs are normal. The left ear is markedly swollen and tender to palpation. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? A. Reassure him and start aspirin. B. Reassure him and start codeine. C. Recommend that he apply cold packs to the ear for the next 12 hours. D. Recommend that he apply hot packs to the ear for the next 12 hours. E. Refer him to a surgeon for immediate drainage of the lesion. Okay. So look at what's going on here, right? So this kid seems to have like a problem with the ear, right? The outer ear, right? The auricle, right? Kind of like a blood collection, kind of seems like a hematoma, right? The thing is, whenever you have something like this, you need to drain this, right? You need to drain this. And the thing is, the ear is an especially sensitive region for stuff like this. And here's why. Here's why. The thing is, your ear is pretty much filled with cartilage, right? A ton of cartilage. So here's the thing that's going to happen if you don't fix this, right? The thing is, cartilage tends to be surrounded by a connective tissue known as perichondrium. Perichondrium has like it brings in the nutrients, the blood and everything, right? That feeds the rest of the cartilage, right? So it's like the hemoglobin for the cartilage, right? So the thing is, whenever you have a hematoma, it kind of separates the perichondrium from the rest of the cartilage, right? And once that blood organizes, you can have fibrosis and all these things, then that cartilage that's underneath can become ischemic. Because remember, cartilage is largely avascular and that can cause problems, right? So what do you do here? Drain that hematoma, right? Drain that hematoma, and you want to put like some kind of dressing that will bring the perichondrium as close as possible to the cartilage so that you can keep restoring nutrients to the cartilage so that it doesn't die, right? In fact, this is kind of worrisome that this has been like 3 days. 3 days and it's worsening. You got to do something about it. If not, the person's cartilage in their ear will become ischemic and die. And then also, they can develop like, almost like, not keloids. They're not going to develop keloids, but they're going to develop like deformities of their outer ear. It's going to look kind of all jacked up, right? So I think it's very important. This boy needs to have this thing drained. So I'm going to go with option E for this one, right? Hot packs are a terrible idea, right? Because it's going to worsen the bleed, right? Hot packs are going to worsen the bleed because remember, heat causes vasodilation, right? I also would not pick option A because aspirin is an antiplatelet drug. It's going to worsen the bleed. It's going to worsen the hematoma, right? Codeine is going to control the pain, but it's not going to prevent the ear from not being good in the future. And then again, apply cold packs to the ear for the next 12 hours. Again, hey, that may help with the bleeding, stopping it. But again, you need to drain that bleed. You need to drain that bleed. So the answer is going to be option E. All right. A 25-year-old woman who is 19 weeks pregnant comes to the office for a prenatal examination. Her father had classic hemophilia, A karyotype obtained from an amniotic fluid sample of the patient shows that the fetus is XY. Which of the following should you tell the patient regarding her infant? Option A, the infant will neither have hemophilia nor be a carrier. Option B, the infant has a 50% risk of hemophilia. Option C, the infant has a 50% risk for being a carrier. Option D, the infant has a 75% risk for hemophilia. Option E, the infant has a 75% risk for being a carrier. So this infant is male, right? XY. So think about it, right? So the mom is a carrier, right? The mom is a carrier. The mom has to be a carrier, right? Her dad literally, Yes, her dad was had hemophilia, right? So that means dad's X chromosome for sure had the abnormal hemophilia gene, right? So the woman must have gotten that bad X chromosome from dad. Because remember, women are XX, men are XY. So this woman's dad had hemophilia. So he had the bad X and he had the Y chromosome. Obviously, as a dad, you're not going to pass on your Y chromosome to your daughters. It's your X chromosome you're going to pass on. So you give her the X, right? And then her mom probably gave her another X because she's a woman. So she has to be XX. So she probably has one good X chromosome and one bad X chromosome. Well, the thing that could have happened, that can happen here with this her fetus now that is XY, is the fetus's Y chromosome has to come from the dad of the fetus. So that's not a problem. But the fetus's X chromosome has to come from mom. And mom has one good X, one bad X. There's a 50-50 chance that the fetus could get either X, right? So that's why this child has a 50% risk of becoming a hemophiliac. So I'm going to go with option B for this one, right? That's just the right probability. All right. Now, question 40. An 18-month-old child is brought to the ED by his parents because of fever and irritability. The child was well until 4 days ago when he developed rhinorrhea, nasal congestion, and diarrhea. 1 week ago, he was seen in the office by your partner and received routine vaccinations at that time. His mother says he felt warm to touch 2 days ago, but his temperature was not taken. She has been giving him acetaminophen every 6 hours during the past 2 days. Since this morning, the child has been eating poorly. There is a 4-year-old sibling at home who is healthy. Vital signs are a temperature of 100.8, so that's a fever. That's a temperature over 100.4, right? Pulse is 100 per minute, respirations are 25 per minute, and blood pressure is 100 over 70. On physical examination, the child is irritable. He is uncooperative during the examination and his neck is stiff and painful when flexed. He is whining that he wants to go home. Extremities are cool with normal capillary refill time and there is no rash. These findings are most consistent with which of the following? So A says acetaminophen toxicity. B says aseptic ovarial meningitis. C says gastroenteritis with mild dehydration. D says Reye syndrome. E says vaccine reaction, right? For this one, I'm thinking I'm going to go with viral meningitis, right? Which is also called on the NBMEs, aseptic meningitis, right? So we see this child got a vaccine recently, right? And then now you're seeing that this child has a stiff neck, has a fever, right? Irritable. You know, this is pretty classic for meningitis, right? But if you notice, the fever is low grade. It's not like a crazy, crazy fever. The child seems to be relatively okay for the most part. Right, this tends to go more with viral meningitis, right? The thing is, most of the viral meningitides tend to cause mild symptoms. The only viral meningitis, or let me not say the only, but the classic viral meningitis that tends to cause really bad problems on the USMLE exams is going to be HSV, right? HSV, you're going to have very high fevers, then you have seizures, it messes up your temporal lobes, right? But this is more of a garden variety viral meningitis, right? So remember, if you check their CSF, you're going to see low glucose or, you know, it's going to be just a little bit low, slightly normal, right? Their opening pressure is going to be just normal or just a little bit elevated. The protein is going to be normal or just a little bit elevated, right? So aseptic meningitis, right? And most times you're just going to do symptomatic care. That's pretty much it, right? So I'm going to go with option B for this one. This is not acetaminophen toxicity. You're going to see LFT abnormalities, right? It's going to explode your liver with that NEPQI, right? This is not gastroenteritis. This is not Reye syndrome. Reye syndrome, you're going to see, again, a lot of liver dysfunction, right? A lot of liver dysfunction, right? And Reye syndrome tends to be associated with aspirin, right? Not acetaminophen, right? And then vaccine reaction. Again, this could be a vaccine reaction, right? But again, the more direct answer to this question is viral meningitis, right? Like, there are many kinds of vaccine reactions, of which this meningitis could be part of it. But again, the meningitis answer is just more specific for this question that we just read. So that's like the smarter play in terms of a selected answer. All right. Question 41. A 22-year-old woman is brought to the ED by her parents because of muscular weakness, muscle twitches, and palpitations. She's extremely thin and somewhat cachectic. Her parents report that she has a history of self-induced vomiting and overuse of laxatives and thiazide diuretics. Routine blood studies are obtained. Which of the following findings is most likely to explain these signs and symptoms? Option A, decreased hematocrit and hemoglobin concentration. Option B, decreased serum glucose concentration. Option C, decreased serum potassium concentration. Option D, increased serum calcium concentration. Option E, increased serum sodium concentration. So what should you be thinking about here? I'd really hope you're saying option C, right? This makes sense, right? This person has anorexia, right? And you're seeing a lot of muscle problems. Many people don't give potassium enough credit. Potassium is very important for muscle function. That's just the truth. Very important for muscle function. And this lady has so many risk factors for hypokalemia. Like what, you may say? Well, she vomits, uses laxatives. Those things are going to make you volume depleted. When you're volume depleted, what happens to the activity of your renin angiotensin system? It's going to get cranked up, right? So you're going to make a lot of aldosterone. And what does aldosterone do? It makes you dump potassium in your urine, right? So you're going to develop hypokalemia from that. And then she also uses thiazide diuretics. Well, thiazides, what do thiazides do? Thiazides, they're diuretics. They make you volume depleted. That's going to, again, lead to the cranking up of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So your aldosterone is going to rise. You're going to dump a lot of potassium in your urine. That's going to cause you to have hypokalemia. So I'm going to go with option C here. There's just so many risk factors for that in option C, right? Decreased serum glucose. You're going to have more of like an altered mental status, right? A lot of altered mental status if you have a glucose problems, right? So that's not going to be the answer. Option A, decreased hematocrit and hemoglobin. It's not like she's like bloodletting herself or cutting herself or having like heavy menses or whatever. If anything, this person is going to have like very little menses, right? Because remember, if you're a person that is not eating enough, you have a low BMI, your body's going to be like, whoa, we're not consuming enough calories for us. Why should we try to be sustaining another human being, right? So these people's HPG axis is going to shut down. So the GnRH is going to be decreased. FSHLH is going to be decreased. So their gonad is actually not going to be stimulated. So they're actually not going to be having their menses. They're going to have like a functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, right? So they're going to have almost like no period, right? So they're not going to have a very high risk of, like blood loss and iron deficiency and all those things, right? And then increased serum calcium. No, you're not consuming enough food. Why should you have increased serum calcium? You're probably going to have like decreased calcium. And again, because these people are not consuming enough electrolytes, right? And also they're, you know, they're pooping a lot, peeing a lot, vomiting a lot. If anything, they probably have hyponatremia, right? So I'm going to go with option C for this one. I remember she may have palpitations because she's having her cardiac abnormalities. Remember, potassium, if you have hypokalemia, that can lead to a prolongation of the QT interval, and that can lead to torsade de pointe, right? Okay, now question 42. A 50-year-old woman comes to the office for the first time because of recurring abdominal pain. Review of her extensive medical chart, which she has brought with her, discloses that she has a long history of varying physical complaints. Definitive causes for these complaints have not been found, despite extensive diagnostic studies, consultations with many physicians, and several surgical explorations. She gives dramatic and exaggerated descriptions of her present and past symptoms, and she makes conflicting statements about her history. She has been hospitalized at least 23 times since age 18 years. 23 times. Whoa! Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Option A says borderline personality disorder. B says conversion disorder. C says histrionic personality disorder. D says occult medical disorder. Really? You don't say. E says somatization disorder, right? Remember, it's no longer called somatization. According to the DSM-5, it's called somatic symptom disorder, right? So look at this person. She has physical complaints, but she blows them out of proportion. She literally has physical complaints, but she just explodes them out of proportion, right? So you have real physical symptoms, but you're exploding them out of proportion. That is somatic symptom disorder. So I'm going to go with option E for this one, right? Occult medical disorder is not a thing. Get rid of that. Option C, histrionic personality disorder. These are just dramatic people, right? So if you're a person that watches reality TV a lot, or you spend a lot of time on social media, you're going to see a lot of these people. They're just dramatic, right? They always want to be the center of attention, right? That's going to be histrionic. That's not what's going on here. Option B, conversion disorder. Conversion disorder is you have neurologic deficits that make no sense, right? You have neurologic deficits that make no sense, right? But it's a psychiatric disorder, right? We don't see neurodeficits here, so that's wrong. Borderline personality disorder is going to be a woman that has cutting behavior, right? And then this woman has no middle ground. You're either all good or all bad to her. You're either the devil or a saint. There's no middle ground for those people. We don't see that here, so that's not going to be the answer. So the answer is going to be option E, somatic symptom disorder. All right, question 43. A 27-year-old woman comes to the office for her annual physical examination and says, 2 weeks ago, I noticed some small bumps on the outside of my vagina. They don't hurt, but they do itch a little. She has never been pregnant and she takes an oral contraceptive. Physical examination shows several small moist warts on the labia minora. VDRL test is negative. Pap smear shows moderate high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions. So, you know, HGSIL, that's CIN2. After removal of the vaginal warts, which of the following is the most appropriate next step? Option A says colposcopy. Option B says comb biopsy of the cervix. Option C says endometrial biopsy. Option D says hysterectomy. Option E says repeat pap smear in 6 months. This is something that a person can easily get wrong on the exams. Let me teach you the trick, right? The thing is, according to our friends at the MBMEs, there's a very specific order you take for cervical lesions, right? The first thing you're going to do, obviously, is going to be a pap smear. You're going to do a pap smear. Pap smear is a screening test. And then based on the results of that pap smear, you determine if you do a colposcopy or not. But after a pap smear, you either do nothing afterwards and just resume regular screening, right? Or you do a colposcopy, right? Colposcopy is what is typically done after a worrisome pap smear finding. Colposcopy, look at the name. Colposcopy sounds like microscopy. It's just like microscopy of the cervix. If that colposcopy then shows you something, right? It's almost, colposcopy is almost like a more, like just like a more sensitive test than just doing a pap smear, right? It like really looks at things, right? It's like microscopy of the cervix. And then based on your colposcopy findings, you then get a biopsy sample. You can do a cone biopsy, or you can do a loop electroexcision procedure, or you can do a cryotherapy, right? So again, we've gotten a pap smear and we saw something that is really worrisome, CIN2, right? You got to do a colposcopy after this. I'm going to go with option A for that, right? Option B is something that will come after you've done a colposcopy. Option C, endometrial biopsy, we do it when people have abnormal vaginal bleeding, right? This person doesn't have that, right? So we're not going to do that. Hysterectomy, come on, this person doesn't have endometrial cancer, right? Repeat pap smear in 6 months. No, this is a worrisome finding. You ain't going to be waiting for another pap smear. Go ahead and look closely at that CIN2 lesion. All right, question 44. A previously healthy 54-year-old man comes to the ED at his wife's insistence 6 days after a stray dog sprang up and bit his right leg while he and his wife were walking near the dog during a trip to South America. The bite punctured the skin. He immediately cleaned the wound thoroughly with soap and peroxide and has done so daily since the incident occurred. The area of the bite is not painful and the patient has not had fever or chills. He takes no medications. He had a tetanus booster vaccination 3 years ago. Vital signs today are normal. Examination of the right lower extremity shows healing bite puncture wounds. There is minimal erythema and the area is not fluctuant. Lymph nodes in the groin are not palpable. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step? A says, administer rabies vaccination. B says, administer tetanus immune globulin. C says, order CSF analysis. D says, order an MRI of the brain and spine. E says, no intervention is necessary at this time. Bitten by a dog in a South American country. You don't know the origin of that dog. What do you think we're worried about here? Rabies. This guy has been smart, though. Although maybe a smarter decision would have been to come in, you know, like not 6 days later, right? But the smart thing he did is that he irrigated that wound big time. That is the first step in the management of a potential rabies exposure. Irrigate. That reduces the risk of you contracting rabies by like more than 90%, right? So irrigate. And then typically you want to give the rabies immune globulin into the wound and then give the rabies vaccine in another extremity, right? So we are worried about rabies. So we got to pick some rabies answer here. So I'm going to go with option A for this, right? Administer the tetanus immune globulin is a decent answer, but we need to fix the rabies first. That's just a better answer, right? Because rabies will kill you. Tetanus is not going to kill you, but it may kill you, but rabies will for sure kill you if it progresses. So we're going to pick option A here. CSF analysis, no, right? The rabies probably has not got into the central nervous system by then. Again, do the more pressing thing first. Do the more pressing thing first, option A, right? MRI of the brain and spine, that's ridiculous, right? You're not going to diagnose rabies with an MRI, right? No intervention is necessary. No, you need to do something. Rabies, once it gets to the central nervous system, bye-bye. That's the end of the person's life. All right. Now, question 45 says, a 35-year-old man with hypertension comes to the office because of high fever, malaise, and arthralgias during the past 4 to 5 days. He also mentions having painless red bumps on the palms of both hands during the past few days. He screened medications like lisinopril and aspirin. He denies any alcohol or tobacco use, but admits to the daily use of intravenous heroin during the past month. He has been careful to use clean needles except for one incident 2 weeks ago in which he shared needles with his girlfriend. His most recent heroin shot was yesterday. Vital signs today are temperature of 103.6. Whoa! That's a high fever. Pulse of 120 per minute. Respirations are 20 per minute. And blood pressure is 110 over 68. The patient appears weak and pale. Skin is warm and moist. Small non-tender lymph nodes are palpable in both axillae and in the anterior neck and supraclavicular regions. There is a new grade 2 out of 6 holosystolic murmur heard best below the xiphoid that reduces to the apex and is increased slightly during inspiration. There are several small non-tender erythematous nodules on the palms of both hands. Non-tender. Physical examination is otherwise normal. Based on the physical findings, the most likely cause of his fever is infection with which of the following? So again, let's ask ourselves, what's going on here? What does this patient have? IV drug user. New murmur. High fever. Painless lesions on the hands, right? They're painless, right? So they're probably Janeway lesions, right? This person has infective endocarditis. What is the most common cause of endocarditis? Especially in an IV drug user. It's going to be Staph aureus, right? So the right answer is going to be option D, right? Treponema organisms, that's option E, that's syphilis. Syphilis usually doesn't cause endocarditis, right? Remember, syphilis can cause the painful lesion on the palms and soles. Painless rash on the palms and soles. It can cause a tabes dorsalis and stuff like that. That's not what's going on here, right? Serratia marcescens, that's wrong, right? HIV, no. HIV does not usually cause endocarditis. Option A says Hep B. No, Hep B does not usually cause endocarditis, right? This is a straightforward question. It's going to be option D. All right, let's do question number 10 and then we'll wrap this up. So, a 46-year-old married woman comes to the ED because of increased vaginal bleeding for 2 days. She says her menses have been irregular during the past 6 months and that she has not had a menstrual period for more than 2 months. Huh. Okay. She thinks she may be going through menopause. She says she has a history of leiomyomata uteri but has not had an operation or taking medication. Vital signs are normal. Abdominal examination is normal. Pelvic examination is consistent with an 8-week sized uterus, which is slightly tender. A 5-centimeter right adnexal mass is palpated. The cervical os is closed, and there are small clots in the vaginal vault. Which of the following next steps is most appropriate? So she has had increased vaginal bleeding, right? And, you know, she has not had a menstrual period for more than 2 months. Whenever you see amenorrhea in a woman that is of reproductive age, what is the first thing you always got to do? You need to make sure that she's not pregnant, right? So we're going to do option E, a serum pregnancy test, right? Pelvic ultrasound, do that serum pregnancy test first, right? You may, you know, maybe you're worried, hey, is this an ectopic pregnancy or whatever? But check if she's pregnant, right? It's a blood test, right? Actually, it's blood test or a urine test, right? Pretty easy to figure out, right? So I will do option E first. Pelvic ultrasound doesn't make sense as a right first step. Intravenous conjugated estrogen. No, we're not going to do that. That doesn't make any sense for this. Endometrial biopsy is if you're worried about endometrial cancer, right? But again, this person, check if she's pregnant first. It's like an easy thing to do, right? Easy, non-invasive thing to do. Dilation and curettage, we tend to do that for molar pregnancies and stuff like that, right? But again, check if she's pregnant first, right? You need beta HCGs to even figure out if a person has a molar pregnancy or not, right? So we're going to do option E first. Again, you like the way I teach, you're going to love my classes, right? I have a bunch of really good classes coming up in the month of April, right? 20-hour step 2, step 3 class, last-minute review for step 2, step 3, and then I have some classes for step 1 all the way to step 3, right? I have like a 5-hour social science, quality improvement and ethics class. I have a 4-hour biostatistics class. I have a 2.5-hour MBME test taking strategies class. Many people have taken these classes and found them to be extremely helpful, right? And then in the month of May, I have a 25-hour step 1 class, you know, good for people taking step 1 or people taking step 2, step 3 that have poor basic science foundations. Because again, believe it or not, basic sciences are heavily represented these days on the USMLEs. And then I also have a very, very good 50-hour class in the month of June. It's a 50-hour step 2, step 3 class, only held once a year. All these classes are over Zoom. I'm the one that teaches all these classes. Again, these classes are not come, let information be thrown at you classes. No, you're going to come, you're going to learn pathophysiology, you're going to learn test taking principles, you're going to learn the mechanisms behind things, you're going to learn, hey, how will they present this thing on the USMLE exams, right? Again, many people have taken my classes, done extremely well on their exams, and this is not people from 2 years ago, no. I literally have had people that, you know, took the exams like 2-3 weeks back, they've gotten their results, they crushed their exams, right? So again, if you like the way I teach, you're going to love my classes. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams. And then I also help with ERAS applications, mock interviews, personal statements, and all those things. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify, so you should check those out. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I do address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. I have like almost actually 400 episodes on there as well. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you, God willing, in episode 644. But have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.